George Newland versus Board of Commissioners of the Greenwood LaFleur Hospital. Ms. Desmond.
Thank you. Today, obviously, we are here on a second round of this particular case, and
not only a second round, but the panel ought to look pretty similar.
The panel looks, with the exception of Judge Haynes, does look pretty similar.
I can't hope to look as good as Judge Haynes.
But I think one of the big issues that has been troublesome in this case, and it's troublesome in the sense that this is not an employment case. This is dealing with the attorney-client relationship of an independent contractor.
But, I mean, how can you – okay, so I'll be – since I was the odd man out here, how can you go back on the fact that the prior panel said Reeves? So even if they're wrong that Reeves is the operative authority, how can we change that?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, you can reverse your own decision, I mean, obviously, but
it's a very high standard, exceptional circumstance. I mean, just being wrong the first time out isn't good enough for us to say, hey, even if you could persuade the other two that they were wrong the first time, that's not good enough.
Right. And, Your Honor, I'm willing to address Reeves, I think, even in the context.
This whole Mount Healthy thing just seemed like saying that we shouldn't follow the law of the case, and I didn't find that overly persuasive.
All right. Your Honor, I'm perfectly willing to address Reeves. But in this context, this is a 1983 case, without doubt.
Why is this a 1983 case? It was brought under 1981.
Under the Jett versus Dallas Independent School District of the United States Supreme Court, it said 1981 explicit cause of action does not extend to suits brought against state actors. And therefore, you have to look to 1983 for any remedy against a state actor. And that's under Jett.
Well, 1983 doesn't provide remedies. 1983 just lets you through the courtroom door.
Well, Your Honor, that's what the plaintiff brought in this case was an equal protection claim under the 1983.
I think you brought it under 1981 for breach of contract.
Your Honor, again, under Jett, that's what we've been attempting to argue here, attempting to get this court or to understand, and obviously the district court.
You didn't even raise it the first time around.
I think I did, Your Honor. I think I certainly did.
In the first appeal of this case.
I said it was a 1983 case by virtue of the fact that you could not get a remedy under 1981. Therefore, you had to look through 1983, and I cited the Arendelle case versus City of Memphis for that proposition.
Under 1981.
Beg your pardon?
Why can't you get a remedy under 1981 when it was specifically written to deal with breach of contract?
Your Honor, because the Supreme Court says that the legislative history of 1981 provides that you cannot get that, and it provides that 1981 only applies to private actors. That's U.S. Supreme Court precedent. And it went through the legislative history and specifically stated that 1981 only applies to private actors and not against state actors. And that you have to look to 1983 for any remedy. And then we get into that you have to show a policy or custom to get any remedy under 1983. And that's under Monell, which is a leading case from the U.S. Supreme Court.
We're getting far afield, but are you saying that discriminatory conduct is not a basis for relief under 1981?
Not against a state actor.
All right. How about under 1983?
Under 1983, if you can show a constitutional violation, yes. Constitutional violation with a policy of the governmental entity, yes, there is a remedy under 1983. And that's what we have been saying all along.
Well, that's not what the first panel saw, and the law and the opinion that was substituted for the first panel opinion says there's a tribal issue of fact.
I understand. And I obviously, when I replied to the petition for en banc, I continued to, well, actually, I addressed your issue about Reeves because that was what I was asked to do. But in my original brief, I again was focusing on Mount Healthy because that was a 1983 case.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll consider whether Mount Healthy even applies.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. But anyway, as we get into, I will just go to Judge Haynes' question of actually just assuming that we get into the Reeves case. And we have to talk about, again, we look at the board. We have a 5-member board. And the argument that Mr. Doolin has made, it's been made a lot of different arguments. We had in the complaint, he argued that Robert Moore, who was a member of a community, had made a comment at a Voters League meeting, who in turn had influenced the chairman of the hospital board.
Well, Robert Moore, as I recall, was head of the Board of Supervisors, wasn't he?
He was one member of the Board of Supervisors.
Well, you say he's a member of the community. He's on the Board of Supervisors.
Yes, one member of a 5-member panel of the Board of Supervisors who appoints only 2 members of the hospital board and does not appoint Sammy Foster at all. He has no saying over Sammy Foster's appointment.
I mean, the thing that strikes me is that the last panel, and I may be misunderstanding, but the last panel found there was a tribal issue of fact. So the district judge held a trial. And what happened at the trial was the same evidence was presented as the first trial that was granted a directed verdict on, except now y'all added your side of the story, right?
I disagree. The same evidence was addressed.
Yeah, I thought the same people were called and they talked about the same things. But what happened was you added to it with this stuff about him sleeping and getting bad advice. The thing that strikes me about it, that's quintessential jury stuff. The guy says it was because I'm white. They say no, he was sleeping or whatever. Everybody, the jury looks at everybody who's sweating, who looks shifty-eyed, who looks truthful, who looks untruthful, and they make a decision. So they obviously didn't buy the idea, because if he was sleeping and giving bad advice, they wouldn't have found what they found.
Your Honor, under the Reeves case and his progeny, that's not enough to go to the jury.
Okay, panel found it was, and I'm bound by that, as is, frankly, regardless of the composition of the panel, we're bound by the prior ruling, which is there is a tribal issue of fact. Right. What I'm saying is, what you say is different, is that now you got to put on your case. But your case is that he was sleeping and all this stuff. And the jury obviously didn't believe that, because if they believed that, they wouldn't have found as they did. So then the problem is, to me, I don't see how there's anything for us to do on that. I understand the damages, I think, is a live issue. The question of the $70,000, I would like to hear about that. But this issue of whether there's a tribal issue of fact, we've already ruled that there was, rightly or wrongly, and perhaps wrongly. Perhaps you're right about not healthy, but...
Yeah. Your Honor, the different evidence in this case, which was admitted by George Doolin, which was not presented to the original panel, because we didn't even get to the pretext issue in the first case. That was not even addressed.
Well, all of the witnesses were called as adverse witnesses, weren't they? That
only three.
All right, which three?
Only three. And what? And
which three?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Which three?
Sammy Foster, Gladys Flags, and Walter Parker. Okay, those were the only three. Brian Waldrop and let's see, Alex Maloof were not called at the first trial. And also was missing from the first trial was Doolin's admissions. He admitted to what these board members said about why they had let him go. He did not deny, he did not even present rebuttal evidence that what they were saying was false. He didn't even present any evidence that was contrived.
How did he admit it?
Well, he said, Sammy Foster said that he wouldn't respond and wasn't active in meetings and he didn't review contracts. He did deny he was sleeping at meetings, but he had no response to the remainder of Foster's...
This is when he testified. This is on cross-examination?
Correct. Gladys Flagg said she needed an attorney who was more active in meetings. The hospital had been liable in situations due to the lack of legal advice that he had given. He admitted that he had missed deadlines and did not follow board instructions to file suits.
Yeah, but he also said nobody had ever complained before until they had this meeting in 2005 where somebody said, hey, I think we need a black attorney. And then they said, well, it'd be bad to do anything right now, so let's wait a year. So then they wait a year, and lo and behold, they get rid of Doolin and they get a black attorney. And so, again, I'm not saying necessarily absolute, as a matter of law that was racially motivated, but to me, that's the triable issue that the prior panel found. And then your rebuttal, understandably, is we had a legitimate reason he was missing, you know, he was messing up at meetings, he was asleep, he gave bad advice, and he said, nobody ever complained about that before, I didn't sleep. Why is this all not a jury question? I mean, this sounds so jury-esque.
Okay. Your Honor, if we didn't have the part of Reeves that says that you have to put on, Doolin, not me, had to put on evidence, substantial evidence, that there was pretext, that these reasons were pretext. And in the Reeves case, there was substantial evidence that the reasons given by the employer were false.
That this event at the league meeting happened, and if you believe that then they said, well, we got to wait a year so it doesn't look like it was racially motivated, I think you can believe that from this evidence. Why isn't that enough for pretext?
I don't think
and that they never complained before and never said anything about his poor performance or so-called poor performance so forth before.
First, there was no testimony that they were waiting a year because of what would happen at the junior of the.
They had that comment that it would be devastating, or I may not have the right language, but it would be terrible to do it right away, to fire him right away.
Yes.
Okay, so then that to me sounds like kind of a game plan. Well, we'll wait, and it won't look so obvious if we wait until a year after this meeting.
But, Your Honor, what was happening in this situation, you had three individual board members who were already working to replace Doolin prior to this Voters League meeting. Two of them said when they got on the board, the first thing they wanted to do when they got on the board was to remove him as the board attorney. One of them said that he felt the board was better off without an attorney at all for what they were getting out of Doolin. And these were things that Doolin admitted to. He didn't contest any of these facts. He didn't even present any evidence that they were false. And
well,
that's
he said he wasn't sleeping, and he said nobody had ever complained before.
Well, with regard to the no one ever complained, first of all, there are many different board members. He was over the years. Okay, you're talking about many different board members. And the fact that other board members prior to this particular board didn't complain, that's really completely irrelevant. We're talking about this particular board. And under the Evans versus City of Houston case, merely disputing an employer's assessment, and this is an employment case, of an employee's performance does not create an issue of fact. Under the Reed versus Neopost case, again a Fifth Circuit case, his denial of wrongdoing, standing alone, is insufficient to create a fact issue. And again, I go back to the fact that he admitted to each and every explanation that this individual bore.
You're starting to run out of time.
And I'm
concerned about the $70,000. So let me ask you this. Is your argument that it's too much or that he shouldn't recover any emotional distress damages?
My argument is he shouldn't have recovered any.
Okay.
There was just insufficient evidence.
What does he have to approve? Because I agree, it's somewhat thin. What would he have had to show in order to recover any amount of emotional distress damages?
The usual cases that award and affirm emotional distress usually have testimony of sleepless nights, I gained weight or lost weight, things of that sort. I was unable to go about my daily responsibilities, unable to concentrate. I know the court case law says that they don't have to present medical advice, a medical testimony, although sometimes plaintiffs do. That obviously makes for a stronger case when they do, but I recognize they don't have to do that. But those are the usual cases where we see an award of emotional distress damages where they can be affirmed.
So you're saying that we should, assuming we don't buy into your fact issue argument, if we get to the damages, that we should vacate the $70,000.
Yes. And I'll also tell you, Your Honor.
It's not a remitted, or are you just saying vacate it as being unsupported by the evidence?
Yes. And I also tell you, in Mr. Doolin's brief and his response to this, he essentially almost admits that there's no proof and says, well, just ignore the case law because Mr. Doolin's elderly. And then says, well, you know, they should have, you know, if they hadn't been a public body, they could have gotten punitive damages. So maybe we should just recharacterize this, think of it as punitive damages. You know,
about the fact that he closed his law practice.
He was ready to retire. That was, he's always stated he was ready
to
retire.
What did he testify to in that regard?
He was ready to retire and moved to Madison, Mississippi, where his daughter was located, where his daughter was living.
But he stayed in Greenwood because he wanted to continue as board attorney?
No, he said he was ready to retire, and he was already phasing out his practice to move to Madison, Mississippi, to live closer to his daughter. And that was his testimony. I can't harp too much on the Reeves case because I don't think that it's a jury question just because, you know, Doolin says that's not what I did without presenting some evidence of a false, that this board was not testifying truthfully. Even under Reeves, it says it's not enough to even for Doolin to say it was obviously contrived.
Ms. Desmond, your time's expired. You've
okay.
reserved
Thank you.
5
Thank
minutes
you, Judge
for rebuttal.
Prater.
Mr. Wade.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honor, regarding the damages in this case, the thing I'd have to emphasize to the Court is, in the first place, I don't know of any case from this circuit where this circuit or any other circuit has just said, well, there was zero proof of emotional damages, therefore we remit it to zero. Now, there are cases where your honors have dramatically reduced the damages awarded. The primary one is
this is awfully thin. I mean, I was humiliated, and I felt like these people were my family and lost my family. I mean, he doesn't say anything about sleepless nights. He doesn't say he's unable to function. I mean, it's a very, very thin record, and you guys could easily have put on the evidence if it was there. I mean, so it seems to me that you have a very this is solely in his ability to testify about how he reacted emotionally. And he said almost nothing. And so I'm having trouble understanding how we could, if there's ever going to be a sufficiency challenge to emotional distress damages, this will be the case. So tell me how we can uphold it.
Well, Your Honor, never mind
the amount, but just uphold it at all.
Well, Your Honor, for court, please. The only thing I'm saying is Your Honor's taken an unprecedented step so far as I know. We've both cited cases to say, you know, we had the Vadi case, which counsel points out is very similar to this case, so they claim it's almost exactly like this case, and Your Honor's remitted, I believe Judge Barksdale was on the panel, remitted it to $10,000. But we have other cases that are on similar facts where similar verdicts have been upheld. They're all cited in the briefs. But let me mention this to Your Honors. As Your Honor knows, you have to review Judge Aycock's decision for abuse of discretion. Judge Aycock sits there and observes his demeanor just like the jury does. The jury doesn't necessarily look at the cold words on paper. They look at his demeanor, and when he makes a statement, well, they're like family. Like, I would talk to those department heads, and it meant a lot for me to them to ask me questions. And I did not intend to. I was going to retire and go down there with my daughter. But I stayed up there longer because of this job. This was important to him. It's not much money. Mr. Doolin's, you know, he's retired. That's not the issue. But it just meant a lot to him. And the jury, Your Honor, that's what the Seventh Amendment entrusts the jury to do, to make those determinations. And if counsel, it's really my fault if I fail to make it specific enough, that really doesn't seem to be very just. I said frankly, Your Honor, if we looked at the comparable verdicts we've had in North, and Judge Aycock's familiar with them, you know, she's the judge up there. If Your Honors gave a remitted to her, I have every belief they'd go back and give this much or more the second time based on what they do in other cases. And it's not just based on the cold words on paper where you fail to be specific enough. And I just don't think, you know, when emotional damage is an element of damages, for Your Honors to say there's zero damages, the proper remedy would be remitted to her. And I'm just telling you that I believe any jury is going to do the same thing or more. Because a job means a lot to people those people sitting on the jury. Us as lawyers, you know, we're lawyers, we can get another job. But people on the jury think, you know, jobs are important. They're important to prestige. And so we think the damages testimony should be affirmed and there shouldn't be another trial. But certainly shouldn't be reduced to zero. But it's just worthless to get fired as board attorney. That's a very prestigious.
Well, I mean, the $12,000 is back pay, so I
yes,
mean,
ma'am.
So he's not getting nothing.
Well, a jury would think that you've really not remedied this person to give him the back pay. You know, the $12,000, it's almost no remedy. To make discrimination meaningful, I would think the jury would want to give
well,
some
the
amount.
The problem is you can't do punitive, so, I mean,
that's true. We can't give punitives. That's true.
And so that's what you're really talking about, punishing.
Well, Your Honor.
Group, and the fact is we can't. Well, I'm sure that this has gotten publicity and so on, and these are public officials and so on, so I'm sure they've had their share of you know, embarrassment in the community and so on, and if you want to call that a punishment. But as far as punitive damages, that's not available.
Well, yeah, I don't want to just go back and argue. I just respectfully, I feel like there's enough evidence there to support the verdict, and certainly to say it's worth zero to get fired from this prestigious position or lose this prestigious position is worth zero. You know, it's kind of like a wrongful death case. Something, losing a position like this is tragic. You know, the jury knows how that affects. Your Honor, let me talk a little bit.
What evidence did you put on at this second trial about the league meeting and the newspaper article that followed the next day, and then subsequently, I believe it was Mr. Moore going to see two members of the board about wanting a black attorney? For example, did Jordan or Perkins or I forget the other person there at that meeting, did they testify, or was this just through the newspaper report?
Yes, no, sir, they testified. I called all of them adversely.
All right, would you name them, please, your adverse witnesses?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Name your adverse witnesses.
All right, so we called the three Voters League members. Jordan, who's a state senator and a city councilman, Moore, who at that time was president of the Board of Supervisors, and Willie Perkins, who was attorney for the Board of Supervisors and whose wife was the mayor in an elected contest for mayor, three influential citizens. And then we called the newspaper reporter. On the difference between this trial and then we called Mr. Doolin. So when they moved for their judgment as a matter of law, that was only evidence for the jury. They had not put on their case. They never renewed that motion, by the way, after that. They just filed a motion for judgment as a matter of law after we called our witnesses, which, you know, established the prima facie case and direct evidence. They moved for judgment as a matter of law. And then when they put on their case, then they called as part of their case the witnesses we called the first trial, the three black witnesses. The difference was...
Name them, please.
Parker, Foster, and Flags, the three black members of the board. And then they called the two white members, which in my opinion was some of the most helpful testimony that we had, taking evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. First of all, they didn't go along with the black people saying he was sleeping at the meetings. That was unique to the black members, that he was sleeping or dozing off or whatever. Neither one of them said that. Mr. Maloof said, and this was one of the most embarrassing moments for the defendants, I thought, said, well, we needed somebody younger. And then he said, I retracted that. We just needed somebody who was, you know, our finances had been going down, and we just wanted to put somebody in there, you know, to help the hospital's financial situation. But the thing that Mr. Maloof helped us with, I thought, Your Honor, most was a question counsel was trying to point out. He said, you know, on their saying you got to show a majority of them were prejudiced. He said, well, I just left it to the president. Basically, I had an understanding that when I got to be board chairman, I could pick.
And the president was Flags?
The president at that time was Flags, but there was also evidence that Foster was the initiator both of putting Sanders and of the initial removal. You know, there's testimony that Flags came up with Sanders, but there's also testimony in the record.
Sanders is the black attorney that was hired.
Yeah, it was hired.
Place Doolin.
When nobody knew anything about her qualifications, basically. They just really couldn't come up with any reason about how they chose her. And Mr. Maloof, of course, the other thing that helped us, he said, well, I have an attorney for my company. He's a very well-respected, successful businessman. I got an attorney for my company who I'd like to have. He's a business attorney. He's what we need. But he never put him forward or anything, and that supposedly really highly qualified white attorney never got considered. Your Honor, but when they say we should have had an instruction, you know, they're saying we should have had an instruction that you've got to prove a majority. That's one of the main arguments she makes in her reply brief. You've got to have an instruction. That would not be appropriate under the facts of this case. When we had this testimony by Maloof that I was just looking to whoever the president wanted, that's what I was going to do. And then basically I wanted somebody younger or something like that, but I would go along with whatever the president said. So even though there might be cases, Your Honors, where, you know, an instruction, you got to have a majority, would be appropriate. But there's no question that the defendant was acting under color of state law under 1983 because they knew, everybody says they knew about that Voters League meeting. They knew about the statement that Foster made that in time we're going to get a black attorney in there. So there's no question about the color of state law requirement. So, I mean,
what is your take on the law of the case issue? What can we consider in terms of, you know, your opponent's making the argument we should set aside the jury verdict entirely because there wasn't a triable issue of fact. What is your view of how law of the case plays into that issue?
Your Honor, the reason I say it's the law of the case, in any two cases of tried, there's going to be some differences. You know, we can't quote just 100% precisely what was said in the first trial, but substantially the same. So the court's already considered this evidence essentially the same evidence. As far as Mr. Doolin admitting, well, he admitted, yeah, I made a mistake in a bankruptcy filing. That was in evidence. But that wasn't necessarily the reason why they fired him. He pointed out for reasons why it was harmless and why they had a novation and it didn't make any difference. And they never made an issue of this. In fact, the ones that were called didn't even seem to know anything about it, that had ever been an issue. And the jury was entitled to prove that had nothing to do with why he was fired, or if he did, one of the reasons was race.
Was the tape of the board meeting, was it played at the first trial? The tape?
Yes, sir. It was
played at the second trial.
I believe I'm right. I introduced it at the first trial, and then I decided it wasn't helpful to us overall, and they introduced it over my objection to the second trial, but it was played both times. Your Honor's dissent and a majority points out that can be read both ways. They knew they were being taped. They were aware of what had happened and said, it's a good thing we didn't go back and do this right after the board meeting. And it was Foster, you know, Foster's participation in it, who's the one that made the statement. He's in there participating in the decision to get rid of him. So you can read that tape either way, but it's up to the jury to decide what reading to give it. It's just like it was at the first panel. Your Honor,
what do you make of the argument that he hasn't rebutted the arguments of why he should have been fired? In other words, you said about the bankruptcy filing, but it seems to me that there's pretty strong evidence of his incompetence, to use the term, and that's a valid reason to fire him.
Well, Your Honor, if the court please, in the first place, I think it's exactly what we dealt with before, but in every case, I've never seen a discrimination case where the defendants don't make some criticism of the plaintiff's performance, and the issue is that real? If that's real, why weren't you bringing it to him at the time? If one of them said he didn't tell me I had a conflict of interest in 2003, but he never complained about it at the time. And then according to him, his wife's got a similar conflict of interest today.
I'm wondering, you have this league meeting and somebody makes this remark about we need to hire a black attorney. Does that mean that then Doolin has got a free pass for the rest of his life? They can't ever fire him because that comment was made. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think it's a very troublesome comment, but I'm trying to take the other side and say, does that then immunize everything he does? He can make mistakes and sleep and all this stuff, and they can never fire him because they're going to be accused of racism.
All right, well, Your Honor, all I can say is it's a jury issue. In this case, we had that comment that was made, not only the comment, but the fact that Foster said, I'm not going to do this right now. And he said, are you going to do it at the next meeting? No, it'll happen in time. We're going to replace you with a black person. And then they ultimately put a black person in there, apparently taking evidence in the light most favorable to us, with no consideration of what her qualifications were. They just considered black applicants. So it just happens that we have one additional bit of evidence in this case. Your Honor, regarding these 28J letters that have been written, this case is not like the Staub case. You know, she's saying we can't use the Staub case from the U.S. Supreme Court because of the color of state law requirement. But in this case, our proof is that these board members knew that the discriminatory basis of the decision, that is, that they knew that that Foster had made this promise that and eventually we're going to put a white person in there. So they acted. It's their discriminatory animus. It's not exactly like the Staub case that both sides discuss in the brief from the U.S. Supreme Court where a supervisor is prejudiced. In this case, they knew about the prejudice both of the three people that appeared at the board meeting and of Foster's agreement to go along with it.
Now, at the league meeting, and as I understand it, the league was founded by Mr. Jordan?
Yes, Your Honor.
And at the time of the meeting, he was both a city council member and a state senator?
Yes, sir.
And who initially made the comment at the board meeting, when are we going to get a black attorney, or words to that effect?
Well, the testimony is that from some of the witnesses, that all three participated to some extent, but it was initiated by Foster, the board president. It was initiated by Moore, the county board of supervisors president. And it's not just that he's one member. Mr. Parker, one of the board members, testified that he's the person that nominated him. Mr. Maloof said Moore, put me on the board. That is, the president of the board of supervisors put me on the hospital board. So, Your Honor, we live in a democracy. I mean, any jury can say that influence is important. You know, that citizens influence the voters, respectable public officials, Board of Supervisors, Your Honor knows, that's the most prestigious, influential people in the state of Mississippi, as members of those Boards of Supervisors. And they appoint three members. And Mr. Moore is obviously a very active, influential member who a jury applying good common sense would think that he would have influence. If they want to maintain those very prestigious positions on the board, they would tend to want to please Mr. Moore. Now, that's just common sense.
As I understand the record, following that board meeting, the next day was the newspaper article.
I believe that's right, yes.
Then what period of time elapsed before someone who had been at that board meeting, perhaps it was Mr. Moore, went to see two members of the hospital board about getting a black attorney?
Your Honor, my best reading of the record is that Moore went to see Parker, I believe it was Parker, about 6 to 8 months after the board meeting. But he testified he'd already seen flags about it before that, before the board meeting ever came up. And they claim that he was just, that all that Moore was telling them was that, well, he's just a bad board attorney member. But there's other evidence that was said, like the newspaper reporter said, and so did Maloof, that the express statement Moore said or kept saying at that Board of Voters League meeting was, when are you going to replace this white attorney with a black attorney? So he made both. He made disparaging comments. Your Honor, as far as your earlier question, Judge Haynes, about sleeping at the board meeting, I think it's important that nobody said he was sleeping at the board meetings except these black members. It's just strange that they would notice that, and Mr. Durden testified he was shocked by that testimony. He'd never heard of that till this suit was filed.
Now, who is Mr. Durden?
I'm sorry, Mr. Doolin. I'm sorry, Your Honor. He's a criminal defendant I had years ago. I'm sorry.
Now, Mr. Durden Doolin was the newspaper reporter?
Oh, Mr. Darden was a newspaper reporter. Mr. Doolin testified, I had never heard that I was sleeping at the board meeting until after this suit was filed. That's the first I ever heard of that. That's what Mr. Doolin said.
And you're saying no one else that attended the board meetings observed that? That's your point?
Well, the three black members now say they did.
Right, saying that no neutral.
Right.
The three members of the commission, Board of Commissioners, are interested witness, but so no disinterested witness.
That's exactly right, John.
Observed this or testified that they observed this.
That's exactly right, John. Your Honor, if the court please, if there are no further questions, I think.
Let me clarify something. I think you've told us this implicitly, and I want to hear your direct answer on it. If we remit the emotional distress damages, are you saying that instead of accepting that remittiture, you will, I can't ask you what you're going to recommend to your client, but you're saying that a second trial is possible? On damage.
Your Honor, the only reason we wouldn't do another trial is because of his health. He's not been able to go through it. We otherwise would, because just based on the verdicts I've seen in race cases, both white and black, it's not unique to whites. It's comparable. That you get, you know, this is comparable. This is a working class jury up in the Northern District of Mississippi, and jobs are important. And they don't see the technical distinction counsel's going to make. Well, he was a contract employee. You know, he was a contractor, not an employee. They don't see that. They see somebody got removed from his position. There's nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Desmond.
First of all, I'd like to address some misstatements made by Mr. Wade. The tape was not played at the first trial. There was a transcript of the tape that was introduced, but the tape was never played at the first trial.
And the transcript was also introduced at the second trial?
Yes. The tape was played with the transcript, but the only thing that Mr. Wade introduced was the transcript at the first trial. I would also like to state that what Mr. Wade fails to point out at the Voters League is that Sammy Foster, without contesting, stated that race could not be used in a decision of the board of the hospital board. He did not say that.
When did he say that?
At the Voters League meeting, and there was testimony to that fact by the reporter. Even the reporter said that Sammy Foster said that race could not be used in any hospital board decision.
That's my recollection of the record. So why is that not a jury question? Whether they believe Mr. Foster, did he so testify at this second trial?
Yes, Mr. Foster.
He said he was asked, what, if any, comment did you make in response to being told we need to get a black attorney? He said, race can't be considered.
No one contested that. It was uncontested.
Well, was it testified? Was it evidence at the second trial?
Yes, and
right.
It was uncontested. No one contested that. That is what he said.
Well, do you have to contest something in order for the jury to consider the veracity?
For it to be a jury question, you have to have that somebody who says that no, that's not what happened, and that is an uncontested fact.
Well, if that was the way we tried cases, we'd have a totally different trial system that you've got to get up there and keep saying, no, you didn't say that, no, you didn't, so the man on cross-examination keeps saying, yes, I did.
Well,
if you think it's not worth bringing up again, well, you just leave it alone, and then you take your chances with the jury.
Yeah. I'm just saying the contested facts is usually what juries, that's why we have them.
Well, you have interested witnesses, there's always a question of credibility, and I agree you can't just rely on proving the negative by saying nobody believes these people, but that is part of the aspect of it, that Foster could say, hey, race isn't, part of it, ha-ha, and it's just how he says it. He might be saying that for the record, speaking into the lapel, however, that isn't what he meant. And so, again, that's all part of what the jury considers.
Right. But, Your Honor, you also have to understand there were three individuals, the hospital administrator, Mr. Maloof, and Mr. Moore, who thought they were going to this meeting to give a report about the hospital, and then they were hit with this. They did not go to this meeting thinking they were going to be discussing the board attorney at all. It was not on the agenda, and this was something they were hit unexpectedly with. And and they tried to handle it as best as they could.
You've lost me on this one. So they went to the board meeting where getting rid of Dooling was brought up, and you're saying the hospital administrator and one of the white board members were not aware of this?
They were not aware that this was going to be discussed.
Well, what has that got to do with the price of tea in China?
I'm just saying they were completely surprised and taken aback.
So what?
They didn't know how to respond to something that was being publicly made. And Mr. Maloof even said, we shouldn't be discussing this in a public forum. This is something that should be discussing in hospital.
Oh, when you say board, you're talking about the board of voters or whatever.
Oh, the voters' league, correct.
I thought you meant the board meeting of the hospital.
Oh, no. I'm saying they were completely taken aback that the voters' league had brought this up when it wasn't on the agenda. And that was not why they were asked to be there.
Foster and Maloof were invited to attend this board of voters?
Voters League. Actually, the entire hospital board was invited, but only Maloof and Foster attended. And the others decided not to attend.
Sounds like they were brought there to be given a message.
They were asked to just give a report on the hospital board, and that was what they thought they were doing.
Is that in evidence, the written invitation?
Yes, not a written invitation. It wasn't in writing. That was just what they were asked to do.
Who testified to that?
Mr. Foster and Mr. Maloof. And also, too, I just wanted to say that when he talks about, comparing qualifications to the replacement, we weren't talking about qualifications of Mr. Sanders. We're talking about his performance.
Mr. or Ms. Sanders?
Qualifications of Mr. Doolin. We're not talking about his qualifications or his history. We're talking about his performance before this board. That was what was at issue before this board. It had nothing to do with his past performance. It was the performance he was given before this board.
But your time is up, so we have this on the tape. But it is it disputed or undisputed that Foster told Moore, we will get a black attorney in time?
No, he said that we will be replacing the attorney, but race cannot factor into that. That is what's undisputed.
Any testimony that I think it's Foster said, we will get a black attorney in time, we can't do it right now?
No. The testimony was, we are going to be replacing Doolin, but race cannot be a factor, and that was corroborated by the reporter.
And then he waited a year to do it.
He and the board waited a year to do the replacement, and the one who brought it up to replace was actually Alex Maloof and the hospital administrator, according to the tape. It wasn't even Sammy Foster.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Desmond. Mr. Wade, thank you.